Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Codex.
This is actually being recorded in three different instances.
Sweet. So we get three times the recording of our mistakes. It's good.
That's one way to look at it.
Hey, welcome to number 282. My name is Codex, and I am the guest for this week. I'm introducing your regular panelists, Mad Jin.
Still sleepy.
Makalua.
Also require caffeine.
The Mian Team.
What could possibly go wrong?
And Dan Q.
Still ginger.
Now we sound one of the fates you managed to chase.
I thought, what can I say that no one's going to expect? So there we go.
You bust out the dye. It should work.
That's true, that's true. Or bleach, you could go blonde.
Yeah, bleach blonde, yeah.
Oh, just in time for summer.
Yeah, grab a surfboard and go to the obvious beach candidate to go surfing.
Yeah, because that's a great place to surf.
Yeah, go to the northern coast. That's about your best bet.
And yet still get sunburn.
I find it particularly egregious, actually, that if I am fighting one civilization and they're the suzerain of this particular city-state, that on the same term, oh, hey, this city-state has declared on you. Oh, gee, that's going to be a problem. Can we have peace? Yeah, okay. So because of that, I'm not particularly concerned, say, oh, maybe I should have some internal trade routes because I want to go smash my neighbor here, and oh, they've got all these envoys already sunk into this city-state. Maybe I should just go ahead and take them, because I'm not going to be able to get their benefit otherwise. But no, actually, I can't get the benefit otherwise because I can get peace way too easily with the city-state. I don't know what's going on with that.
Seems questionable because as long as they're the suzerain, that city-state should be at war with you.
I agree, and that's not the way it is right now. I don't know why that is. It wasn't always that way. It used to be that there was a set number of turns before you could get peace. I don't know if it's scaled with game speed or not, but on online speed, at least, it was 10 turns. And in some cases, it's not even, oh, well, maybe they're more likely to be at peace with you because you've already sent envoys with them and they've got a trade relationship with you. It would make sense, then, that perhaps you can get peace a little earlier than as if you only found about the city-state because they've declared war on you, and now you know where they are on the map because they've declared war on you. It's, I just met you this turn because you're the suzerain of the civ that I just declared on, or declared on me, and make peace button, enabled, click, done, no problem.
Yeah, it doesn't seem right.
We had some feedback on episode 281 of Polycast. I don't know why we would talk about episode 281 of some other show, but we did have feedback on our latest episode, other than this one, because now this is the latest episode. You know what I mean.
No.
Magna Dragoon, first off, had said that I know the things I mentioned were apparent at release with regards to Civilization VI that have already been brought up. I was trying to express shock about the guy who said that the show has too much griping. That was what we were discussing with regards to episode 280, and now we received some feedback that questioned, in particular, whether or not we were uncaring, insensitive on knowledge about certain things, particularly with regards to civilization strategies that are either not domination-based or otherwise beneficial to domination, that we seem to dismiss anything and everything that has not to do with domination. So, to address some of the points that came up, I replied to the thread. It was never said that no panelist had ever played Egypt in Civ 6. That was one panelist. There was no consensus that trade routes should always be internal, but rather one panelist reiterating that that is their position. Admittedly, no other panelist expressly contested that in this instance, though it has been in the past, not mentioning any usernames.
Maybe I'm overselling the domination thing a little bit much. That's not supposed to be taken too seriously, but okay.
Further, my response, many of the panelists' playstyles are rooted in domination, which, when not specifically stated, no doubt comes across. Otherwise, we speak first and foremost to the perspective that we have more or most experience with. We're always trying to acknowledge and incorporate playstyles other than our primary into our conversations. Even where we may not cover those aspects completely, we never do so out of disrespect or dismissal. That it came across that way with respect at any point was and is not intentional. that there was and is much about England, for example, that is domination-based or otherwise beneficial, most likely led to less attention being given to its museum-unique building. We always welcome our audience to raise strategic elements that we overlook and or different perspectives on those that we do not. To have individuals do so not only better enables us to engage with our listener base and by extension the Civ community, but also challenge us as players to think critically about our own positions. We may not always agree on points raised, just as we don't always agree with one another on the show, not mentioning anything, but when they are raised constructively as here, they are appreciated and considered. There was one comment from the thread that I did not address at all in that part, and that was part of the argument from user Victoria on Civilization Fanatic Center, civfanatics.com. I would have liked a guest to have a spot, something they want to discuss, something that makes it interesting for them to be there. And I'm not going to address that specifically with regards to any one episode other than this one, because I know that our guest, our first-time guest today, has a civilization that they very much like to play with and probably has more playtime with this civilization combined than everyone else on the panel. That will become apparent as the show continues on. So, in short, if you are looking to call us out on something, please do so constructively, as was done here, because it allows us to incorporate that into the show, because even though we are the voices of the show, us regular panelists as well as the guests, we want to include as much as possible to represent as much as possible the civilization community, at least insofar as a podcast can, because, you know, there are only so many things we can do. I guess I really shouldn't admit that we have our limits, but we do. Don't tell anyone.
Well, Dan does anyway. Troll. There are a few things mentioned specifically in detail by Victoria that we probably should have covered, to be fair.
Yep.
Because we have the back-and-forth dialogue, it's easy to forget that you haven't said some things, too.
And I wasn't here, so...
Yeah, imagine wasn't here. But that aside, the plus 14 production on the shipyards is pretty darn big. That's not something we should have missed. Some of the other stuff, like flanking on chariots because you have extra moves. Extra moves allows that. I don't know if that needs to be specifically mentioned, but I see where you're coming from there. That is an advantage of the unit. And it's the same thing with the exams. While I do respect that other victory conditions exist in the game, especially with the tourism one, I'm particularly vexed by how Civ 6 handles it and its detail on it in general. I hate to be dismissive of it, and to be fair, there are people who enjoy playing that way. In the past, I played for peaceful victory conditions in Civ. It's just so poorly tuned, and the information on it provided in the game is so weak that it's hard for me to take some of these victory conditions too seriously. But that is not the opinion of everybody on this show, or certainly not of everyone in general.
Yeah, it has nothing about being taken seriously. It's about...
I guess, but every time I play England, that plus 10 is really strong, and then, yeah, I can build museums, or I can just continue to abuse their admittedly extremely strong overseas play, and I just go for the latter.
British museums are very strong. Still broken a little bit, buggy. If it's a former English city, you can always build a British museum. And if the British take over somebody else's city, you cannot build a British museum. But then you have Mary Leakey for all that wonderful, wonderful excess science. In theory, it's supposed to be excess tourism, but that also seems to be broken. And what Victoria is talking about with the power triangle, with your city center and harbor and commerce district all being in a triangle on the coast, that's really good for pretty much anybody, just England gets it better.
Yeah, all England has the better harbor, basically.
England gets it better because when you're off-continent, you get extra gold anyways, which rolls up into the adjacency stuff. And not to mention, well, that extra trade route, always good.
Yeah.
And speaking of trade routes, yes, most of your trade routes should be international. You only need trade routes internal when you're building things or very early game.
But you're at war with everyone.
You're not going to be at war with literally everyone, unless you're playing Alex and going full-on Dom. Because, you know, city-states count, too.
Yeah, that's true. And the envoys can be helpful, especially if you have a quest on that.
I mean, internal trade route, once you start getting up to 3 or 4, then, yeah, if you get a city with the right districts in it, then, you know, 4 extra production for a new city is really good. And obviously, you want to try and get your new cities connected to the trade route set up so that you can extend them a little bit further. But other than that, I'll take 14 gold over 2 production.
right to do as and against. This time, France. Did he want to win a culture victory? Because I think he'd win a culture victory with France. Plus 20 production towards medieval, renaissance, and industrial era wonders, and tourism from all wonders is doubled. So, there you go. All the tourism you want.
Well, you kind of have to have the wonders to begin with.
Well, yeah, but you're getting a bonus. You're getting an incentive.
And I got to say, the medieval through industrial era wonders are the only ones you really want to build anyway.
The production bonus is timed well.
Yeah, because that's all the ones they give you the free government slots.
Ah, the fun stuff.
All the good stuff.
Catherine specifically has an extra level of diplomatic visibility greater than normal with every civ she's met. And she also gets an extra spy with castles.
Yeah.
So just in case she didn't already have the French spying on you enough.
Yeah, so that extra visibility means when you first meet her, she doesn't have to have a delegation with you to get that first level. But if she does, hey, she's going to get even more information.
Yep. Frankly, getting a spy at Castle's tech is not exactly a good tech, and no one really beelines for that. But early spy is a good spy, provided you could build it.
Yeah, for you're not busy building those wonders.
She also has the chateau, speaking of culture.
Ooh, shiny, shiny, shiny. Unique tile improvement. It has to be adjacent to a river, but it's plus one culture, plus one appeal. It's an extra two culture if adjacent to a wonder, and plus one gold if adjacent to luxuries. So I guess you want to ring your city with chateaus, put the wonders out there somewhere?
Get you pretty far in the culture tree pretty quickly if you set it up.
Although your city probably wouldn't grow very well.
I was going to say, not on a floodplain as an example, you know, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, no.
You need to intersperse chateaus efficiently. Just spamming them is not really a useful thing.
Well, you want to take advantage of their bonuses to the most you can.
Sure.
Decent.
Yeah, I mean, they give plus one appeals. So that's kind of nice. Although, not a huge bonus for appealing on the specific tile itself because, well, you already have it. The plus two culture of adjacent to wonder, well, that's good. And if you put your wonders in certain positions, you can slip a chateau in and attach it to multiple wonders or build a wonder and then surround it with chateaus, depending on your rivers. Extra gold for adjacent to luxuries.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. It's not like we don't have a billion gold in the game anyway. Especially since it will be riverside, so you're going to get at least your base food out of it. Decent source of early culture if you can get one of those early wonders up quickly.
Yeah, it really depends on your terrain and what wonders you can pick up quite a bit. But if you can, it's there.
No doubt, if you are playing as France, people will be noticing or ought to be noticing that you are really pushing the culture. So you may want to defend yourself. Well, at the time where you're really starting to push that wonder construction to go along with your civilization's ability, there's a certain unique unit that can not only help defend your lands, but hey, maybe if you've got some nice cultural stuff in your land, she might want it too. And this will help her get it.
I'm going to defer to one of the Canadians to try and pronounce that.
The Garde Imperial?
Yeah, that.
Thank you. Yeah, because if I tried to do it with the proper accent, it would not sound right. They get a bonus for fighting on the starting capital's home continent. They earn great general points from kills and don't require strategic resources. Yay, units that don't require strategic resources.
The unfortunate of it is it does show up at military science.
Because
that's not exactly core line. At least
it's hard to abuse home continent advantage with that.
It's
not nearly as good as the Redcoats bonus on not home continent, which there's a lot more land that isn't than is.
Well, yeah, this is basically you conquer your home continent if you're going for like a generic how to use these really well, fill it in with cities and wonders, and then you build a crap ton of Garde Imperial and just like never leave the borders, and then you'll be okay.
Yep, defend yourself, culture up, win the game.
And just hope you spawned on a continent that's actually large, or at least large for your area. The randomness of the continent scripting can give you a really tiny, crappy one.
Or your continent spans two or three islands.
Ooh, and not all the same. And of course, don't forget the great general points for killing. Somebody comes attacks you, you can help kill your way to a great general.
Which will then help you kill even more.
Yep.
And you get more great generals.
Mwahaha.
And then you can position those great generals across your landmass, your home continent, to better defend your situation. Yep. And unsurprisingly, Catherine, in terms of her agenda, does not like civilizations who ignore espionage activities.
Oh, yes.
But how does she know I'm ignoring it?
Because she knows. She owns her spy master.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes we have leaders that are like, hey, you're trying to do what I do. I don't like it. But in Catherine's case, hey, you're not trying to do what I do. I don't like it. So she likes competition.
No, it's not competition. She doesn't like people who have their head in the sand and don't know what's going on.
Exactly. That means they're not competition because they have their head in the sand.
Anti-ignorance?
Yeah.
That extra early spy can be useful. You can always burn people's stuff down or steal so much money from them that they go bankrupt.
Yeah, or perhaps filling your museums there trying to steal some great works, maybe, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, and we kind of danced around it, but if you're France, you're probably going to want some theater districts as well.
Really?
Yeah, I know, right? I imagine a district specifically for culture to go for a culture victory. Yeah.
Well, if
that's
you're
implausible.
You can always build all those nice happy wonders and go do something else instead. You don't have to go for culture victories, France.
Oh, no, you don't have to. No. You could use your culture generation to combat other people who are trying to go for culture.
Yeah.
And push your way through the civic tree to do something else.
Our next civilization is Germany. They're good, but not as good as they were before the patch.
There's still some bitter bunnies out there about the overlap.
Huh.
Getting nerfed to death.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have that enormous adjacency bonus, but they also, because of how all of the unique districts didn't count towards the district cap, Germany was in the interesting position of being able to instantly drop three districts at top one when they found the city. And with how the district cost scale didn't change after you planted them, that was another big advantage for them. So they had a lot going for them previously.
Yeah,
and
it was a little
now
silly.
They're just solid instead of, like, lol.
Instead of lol broken.
Yeah. Although, I admit, I haven't used the U-boat much in single player, so I can't.
I don't think anybody really uses submarines.
But the Hansa's good. Hansa's very good.
Yep, replacing the industrial zone.
They have an objectively great leader bonus in the ability to just shank all the city-states. As we all know, that's the only correct way to play.
Also an additional military policy slot to help you along with that, or whatever else.
The military policy slots are good.
Yep.
Well, when you're conquering stuff.
Well, even if you're not conquering stuff.
That's true.
Having that extra military policy slot really means keeping the reduced unit costs while swapping in and out of being able to either build encampments faster just so you can get a few more down, or upgrades, or pillaging benefits.
Yeah, and you can hold on to some of that while you're in less aggressive setups, or you can just have all the military policies as a fascist late game. It's not as flexible as a free wildcard slot, but it's still very good.
Mm-hmm. Raise free?
Yeah. Frederick likes civilizations who do not associate with city-states and does not like suzerains of city-states, or those who conquer city-states, despite his own benefit towards conquering city-states.
Yeah, that was his city-state.
I don't want to conquer all of them.
You're probably not going to be on good terms with this guy.
Well, he can be, but if you can be a suzerain of a city-state that he doesn't know about.
That's true.
Sometimes.
I mean, it's not impossible, but that's one of the less favorable agendas for playing nice.
Yeah. I'd prefer if his agenda was more specific. If he had targets like, I'm going to take out these ones, and then those are the only ones that his agenda would trigger on, versus all of them everywhere. It just seems it could use some refinement. Same for the Greek one.
Oh, we might be talking about Greece this episode, too. I don't know. Who knows these things?
So, Hansa, Beta, then an industrial zone.
Especially if you have resources near each other, if you can get efficiency.
Some people have to adjust their mental picture of what is good when you're playing as Germany because, you're not looking for a bunch of mines or quarries or stuff all next to each other. Unless, of course, they have resources. But you are looking for places with resources, and there's a lot more resources than there are mineable territory. You could easily get a Hansa up to a decent adjacency in a lot of cities.
Yep, plus one production from each. Woo!
And that's strong because you don't need a lot of pop. Like, you could get a ton of production off relatively low pop. Work a couple hammer tiles and you're getting that as well. It's impressive.
Plus, the Hansa also likes being next to the commercial district.
Yep, plus two production. Plus, you also get plus one production for every two adjacent district tiles. So, cluster them together.
Yep.
You do have more to consider when placing it, but it's potentially really strong.
And if you happen to be on a water map, then you can go harbor, commercial district, city center, Hansa. And then pump out the Venetian arsenal on the coast.
What's that? You constructed a ship. Here, have another.
Yep.
Water, Scythia.
And then, of course, if you find yourself some industrial city-states, they can give you added production for not just the capital itself, but every one of your Hansas. Oh, man. Don't even have to be their suzerain for it.
There's a good chance that Germany's going to be pulling in all the engineers hand over fist if you're playing well. And since there's a lot of good engineers in there, you kind of want as many as possible.
Yeah.
Yep, and seeing as how you construct under any unique district, as we talked about before on the show, half cost, as if you needed another reason to construct a Hansa.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, they go up fast, and they are very good, so you should not put them off very long.
And then that will help you construct whatever other district slash buildings slash units slash whatever you need in order to do what it is that you want to do.
Well, the second thing you're going to be building is the other district that you placed at Pop 1.
Yeah.
Whatever that happens to be.
Because Germany still gets the one more district thing. You just don't get two more because the unique one is free. So it's still really good. It's not as broken.
Yeah.
Convert that into a commercial industrial powerhouse. Just slap down commercial hubs and houses everywhere.
Yeah.
You don't need no science.
Well, I mean, you can add science at top four as well. It's not like it's long behind if you want science.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from, like, very early rush play, this is one of the stronger saves. You don't really have anything going for you, like with a sword rush or something. But after that, it's pretty strong.
Okay, so I don't know who wrote this right up on the Wikia. You can focus purely on military. You can simply conquer and absorb any nearby city-states to expand your empire, and you won't have to worry about barbarians or another civ declaring war on you, since you'll be able to raise a decent army without having waste turns on British settlers. I mean,
how is this unique to Germany? Or, like, yeah. Relevant?
Yeah, I don't know. You'll still have to worry about barbs. Just if you go pure military, you'll just kill them, but you'll still be there, and another civ may still declare war on you.
Yeah.
Especially if you go conquer a city-state, they will.
If you're playing against Germany, and I know where you are early on, you're a target.
Now, I kind of like letting them conquer a few city-states, because you can go get that liberate bonus.
It is true. If you get some, like, woofer city-states, that +7 is pretty significant.
Well, it's basically the equivalent of the very first melee bonus.
Yeah, but it'll stack with it.
Yep.
And it works on cities, too.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, if they're going after city-states that I want to remain independent, or, man, that's a really nice city, if they take that over, they're going to be in that much greater position to pose a threat to me. I'd rather them not take the city-state. But then again, it might be by the time I see them, or I know where they are, well, you're going to take the city-state before I get a chance to get there. So then, yeah, okay, I'll get the liberate bonus, because besides, I want the liberate bonus, and I don't need or perhaps necessarily want to manage that city-state myself. I just rather have the bonus from it.
Could you imagine if, like, the AI actually planned out its cities well and placed its Hansas in a way that could make this a threatening civilization? This could be a high priority rush target on its own merit.
Well, it's the economic powerhouse civ.
Yeah. So yeah, you don't want to usually leave those alone in general, but the AI isn't very good at taking advantage of its bonuses in this regard.
And speaking of the AI, perhaps issues with it is the reason in considerable part that we dismiss the U-boat, or that we dismiss submarines, or we dismiss most anything on the water in general, because the AI is deficient in that area. I mean, yeah, the unit itself, it's about 11% cheaper to construct, but it in itself is not particularly impressive, although I think it should be historically.
Yeah.
But in any event, if the AI was a little better on water, then I might pay more attention to it. So we just want to reiterate, or at least I want to reiterate, it's not the U-boat's fault. That's not our primary issue, at least I don't think it is with us, with regards to the U-boat or anything that goes on the water for that matter.
10 extra combat strength, as long as you're in the ocean, is almost a third of what you need to one-shot something.
And then you very get good.
Plus one sight means you're not going to accidentally stumble into somebody else's navy with it. And since it's ranged and a naval raider, you do some nice stuff with that.
In terms of victory conditions, I mean, Germany is pretty versatile, and I think we've been emphasizing either directly or indirectly domination, but my gosh, space victory? Man, that stuff is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like some production? Here you go.
Anything, because they functionally constantly have an extra district for population threshold, so they can pretty well push any victory they want. They're just straight economy boost.
Yeah, I mean, with all the Hansas, that makes wonder building easy.
Yep.
A little competition there for the mid-game wonders. Say you're using Hansas and then your extra district's a theater. There you go.
Yep.
I mean,
and
getting
you
a free
10-pop, and you still have, like, the research, the theater, and you can do whatever else you want with the 10-pop one. It scales pretty quickly, because it gets harder to grow cities, and, well, Germany has less to worry about when it comes to districts that way.
Yep, especially since the one that'll give them the most production is half price.
Yep.
So even later in the game, it's still worth it to do it first. If Germany gets big enough with sufficient enough cities, it can just steamroll any victory.
Even score.
Sure, why not?
Oh, excuse me.
No, that's just a human player thing. Yeah, no, doesn't care about score.
Just a damn thing.
Yeah, just damn things.
The Greeks. The unique ability for the Civ, one extra wild card policy slot in any government.
Yay!
Right from the outset. Thank you, Plato's Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you can get to those wild card policy slots. Would you like to get a head start on a religion? Would you like to get a head start with your science? Great scientist points per turn? Yeah, I know you do. And so I'm going to talk about the unique abilities because we've got two leaders here for Greece. What? Gorgo and Pericles. But first, regardless of whether you choose Gorgo or Pericles, you're going to have the unique unit of the Hoplite. Woo! Plus 10 combat strength if there is at least one adjacent Hoplite unit. So don't just construct one.
Mm-hmm.
And don't just move them on their own. And I've seen that, and it's ouch. I know there's been some conversations about, well, on the Civ Fanatics forums that, you know, it's really not that good, seeing as how the AI tends to spam warriors, so you're only going to be into breaking even there. Maybe you should just be better off constructing warriors yourself. Yeah, but the thing is, you get a couple hoplites together, you go gang up on a warrior, you get a promotion, that thrust promotion on there, and then you're going to get some additional attack against another melee unit, and then you just continue to romple stomp through whatever units are on the map, and then you can go take cities.
Yep, hoplites make it worth getting spears, basically.
But yeah. The unique district is the Acropolis. It replaces the theater district. So yeah, you're going to get plus two culture, plus one food for domestic, plus one culture for an international trade route. Yeah, the food is nice, but let's just keep on going with the culture train here. Hello. You're also going to get plus one culture from each adjacent wonder, district, and city center. Because it's your unique district, you can construct it at half the cost.
Keep in mind, it has to be on a hill.
It does indeed have to be on a hill. And some people say, you know, I would really prefer the production. Well, my first response to that is, do you have something that perhaps you can quarry, for instance? But it's going to be one. It would be one hill that you're talking about here. So I suppose if it's an early city on, then you're wondering, maybe this isn't the best place for a theater district because I got one hill and I need that for production. Okay, then I question perhaps why would you settle that? It's kind of one of those things where, more often than not, I may or may not construct your theater district in the game, but if I'm Greece, yeah, I'm going to be constructing these things. Doesn't have to be for a culture victory. It can just be, I would like to press through the civics tree, thank you very much, to whatever else yeah. It is that I want to go on to.
I want to hit the endgame governance before everybody else.
Oh, yeah, and feel free to bring along a battering ram with your hoplites. Obviously kind of goes without saying.
Obvious. And keeping in mind that that plus 9 combat strength is on top of the usual flanking and support bonuses.
Yes, so it's not as, ooh, warriors are going to do something against it. Well, they can. If the warrior going up is against on a forested hill and you're on flatland, well, again, you should at least have two hoplites in the vicinity. But in any event, elsewise, fine, let's talk about the unique ability that is the Civ. What I consider the greater cultural one, and that is from Gorgo Thermopylae. Combat victories provide culture equal to 50% of the combat strength of the defeated unit.
It's basically Monty from Civ 5.
Yeah.
Go kill things.
Exactly. Barbs are your friend. Maybe you try to isolate a little barb camp so it can spawn some barbs for you, and you can just keep going squish, and you can farm culture that way. And, of course, then if you are Pericles, okay, you've got the Surrounded by Glory ability, plus 5 culture per city-state that you are suzerain of. Well, it's an edge case. It can be beneficial, but my gosh, if you're thinking about culture and then combining with consideration of the Acropolis, I just don't know why you would want to choose Pericles over Gorgo.
You can easily stack that culture, and you don't have to be constantly fighting.
That's true.
Depends on your opponents and whether or not they're letting you become suzerain over all the city-states?
Yeah. I guess that's why I find it more situational as opposed to
yeah.
Gorgo, where you can be a little bit more master of your own domain and just go out and smack things around.
Yeah, the 5% culture is nice per city-state, but yeah, you kind of have to either make sure no one ever knows about any of the city-states, which is kind of hard, or you have to basically kill everybody else so that they stop fighting you for city-states.
Yeah.
Now, there is a certain new wonder that would go really well for Pericles here. The one that gives you envoys for every wonder.
Apadana.
Yeah. you want to really consider getting up there first and then kick that out. Keep pumping good wonders in your capital.
Yes, and of course the plus two envoys you get includes from Apadena itself. So, boom! And then, if we're thinking culture specifically here, as Gorgo going for the culture victory, or just culture victory in general, there's this thing called computers. I enjoy how the tourism yields are doubled when you research computers. Because, you know, when I think of computers, I think of culture.
Well, now the internet can tell you where to go on a trip.
Yeah.
Oh, the
internet can tell you where to go for certain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Cat videos.
I will spread cat videos, and it will dominate yourself with tourism culture.
Gorgos get culture from kills if you want to plow into, I don't know, monarchy or something like that. Getting that mid-game way ahead of everybody else. Or, say, you built your religion around killing things. Because, well, you can. Then you can plow into theocracy really quickly. Being able to get further into the mid-game tech tree, especially the mid-game governments, is a very, very powerful thing.
And in terms of leader agendas, let's start with Pericles, actually. Like civilizations that aren't competing for the same city-state allegiance. That might tie with his unique ability or something. Just like civilizations that are directly competing for city-state allegiance. Seems straightforward. Perhaps we could carry that over to city-state issues with regards to Germany that Matt was mentioning early. Competing for the same city-state allegiance. Now, a little more focused here. And Gorgo, never give up items in a peace deal, and like civilizations who match that approach, dislike civilizations who have capitulated or who have never gone to war. And I know I've said this before, and I can't help but saying it again. So she's going to have an internal debate with herself if I declare war on her.
Yep.
I'm against her. It's like, well, on one hand, you declared war, but it was on me, so... is it six half dozen of the other? What am I on a balance? LOL.
No,
we'll give you war.
Yeah, no, that's good. It shows that you're a strong leader, even if she's going to think that she's going to kill you or not.
Well, there's a fine line between love and hate, so fair enough.
Yeah. I don't mind their agendas on these, but yeah, refinement would be nice. If you can get out there and beat up a few AIs and make them give up even one gold, that will make Gorgo... as an AI, wake up and just go kill everybody.
Oh, because I was just about to say, it took me a few seconds to realize that a cocked eyebrow makes no sound. When you say that you want a refinement with Gorgo or Pericles, which one are you thinking of, or both?
Probably a little of both. I mean, Pericles, obviously, for the city-state. If he had a list of city-states that he was looking to become suzerain of, instead of all of them, especially the ones across the map that he just met, then that would be better, just like Germany.
Oh, yeah, based on whatever bonus it would give them as a suzerain.
Yeah.
And then also taking into account distance, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, first and foremost, I can see, yeah, what the benefit would actually be.
That way you can be friends with Pericles while being suzerain of the city-state that he has nothing to do with. Indies get all the usual fun stuff, including Gandhi.
I really thought you were going to say, Indies got all the fun stuff, including nukes.
Woohoo!
I thought you were going to say...
Face-to-face nuking. All right, so civability-wise, you got your Dharma, which is nice.
No Greg, just Dharma. I went there.
Okay, Dharma, you get the follower stuff from all the religions in your city. Only problem with that is it's really hard to get that going, having multiple religions in your city.
Oh, wait, what do you mean? You just don't go through diplomacy and say, hey, can you spread your religion to... Oh, wait, no, that's not there.
But I only want one.
No, India is best served being in the midst of a bunch of religions, having a lot of religions in the neighborhood. So you really don't want to be going out there and like spreading your religion if you found one. And you don't really want to use inquisitors because bad things happen at that point too, because you knock out all that stuff. And frankly, just straight up pressurization from others is just not sufficient to do it well. Yeah. Dharma is an interesting idea. I like the concept. It's just implementation-wise is a little hard to get going. Other than that, civ-wise, obviously we have the Varu, the good stuff. It is strong like heavy cav, but shows up as horseman. No light cav for you till the industrial era, ever. But that's okay, because, well, frankly, I'd rather have a Varu than a horseman.
Well, yeah, you're going to have 40 melee strengths instead of 36, and then if you're adjacent to an enemy unit, it's actually like you've got another 5 combat strength.
Yeah, well, it reduces the combat strength of adjacent enemy units by 5, and it stacks. So if you're using Vyros to flank, you're not only getting the flanking bonus, you are basically making them pee themselves and they will die very, very quickly.
These things are a nightmare alongside great generals for the movement points. They are nasty.
Yeah, well, they kind of need the great general since they only have two movement versus more for any other mounted unit.
Yeah.
Happen to have the general, then you get three and then whee! You start running around a little bit better. And then, yeah, stacking that -5 for people, you pretty much just stomp on them pretty quickly.
The wiki says they're vulnerable to anti-cavalry units.
No, they're not. What are you talking about? They're elephants. That's cute, but untrue.
Yeah, I would love to see generic spears stand up to decent usage of this.
I'd like to see a pike stand up to you, Varu. Even a pike can't really stand up to the Varu.
And these things with battering rams are not so bad against cities either.
Yeah,
so although Gandhi
no
hates
negative
warmongers, he could certainly be a good warmonger himself.
Yep, because there's no penalty for cav units versus cities.
That sucked anyway. Yeah. I didn't like it, so if I put that in. They needed to do something with cavalry, but I'm not sure that was the right answer.
They're strong. They boot stomp all those silly swordsmen that are running around pretty easily. Don't mess with Gandhi while he's got his Varus out there. Or do, as I've done before, force Gandhi into war weariness to the point where he's going to get rebellions, and then he'll get a Varu army as rebels.
You have to be careful with him, though. You have to trade very favorably on war weariness, which is another hidden role, by the way. Thumbs down on that one for Axis, but yeah.
The leader bonus, you get 5 faith, woo, per civilization that has founded its own religion, and that includes you, and with which you are not at war with. Free faith. Given start of the game, getting 35 free faith pretty quickly in the game is decent.
Yeah, I'm immediately thinking, hello, great person discount.
Well, that too, sheer amount of faith that you can do. Or, you know, if you're not the first one to found a religion, if you've met everybody and there's still a religion out there, you can always buy it with the faith that you got from knowing everybody else who already got one. So that's pretty good. On top of that, any other civilization who wants to fight Gandhi specifically gets double the war weariness.
Or even those civilizations that don't want to fight Gandhi.
You gain just 100% war weariness as you gain it. So it'll make your people upset. And when it comes back to Macedon, it's been shown that Macedon gets a -100%, Gandhi gives a +100%, and those cancel each other out. So Macedon still gets normal war weariness.
Mm-hmm.
Their unique infrastructure, the stepwell, bonus food with extra food for being next to a farm. If it's next to a holy site, you also get +1 faith, but most importantly, you get a full housing out of it, and you actually get a little bit more housing out of it from sanitation, and professional sports will give you a little extra food. Usually drop a holy site next to an area that will get a bunch of farms, slip a couple stepwells in, and your housing problem is taken care of for a while. The extra food, it's not going to be as good as farms are later, but not needing a neighborhood with high appeal later in the game to make up for some of those lacking of housing is pretty easy. So Gandhi can grow a little bit faster in the early game because of better housing. And again, you don't want to spam these things like crazy, but you want to actually use this to prevent yourself from pop stalling, at least till you get to at least pop 10. Other than that,
his agenda.
Gandhi's kind of a peaceful dude. I find his agenda funny when played as the AI, because that's when the agenda shows up. Never declares wars for which he can be branded a warmonger. Oh, shit. Gandhi will always declare wars where he can be branded a warmonger. And he will try to befriend those who maintain the peace. Yes, if you haven't declared war in a while, Gandhi will be happy. And he doesn't like people who have warmongering still on their ledger.
Yeah, and when I read Peacekeeper, I can't help but have a Fleetwood Mac song in my head as we, you know, talk of India.
Mm-hmm. Gandhi / India's, well, more India. Biggest benefit is early in the game, although not nearly as early as some others. You can keep using those Varus right into gunpowder units, really. So you've got some time.
You can still leave one or two around, too, and randomly move them next to an enemy unit before shooting at it or hitting it with other stuff.
They mean leave one or two around. They don't upgrade until
fucking tanks.
I mean, like, just because you don't necessarily want to hit stuff directly with them any longer doesn't mean that they shouldn't be in the vicinity of enemies if you just don't leave them behind.
Yeah. I mean, they are a heavy cav unit, so they get other decent bonuses anyways. And actually, even if you start getting out-tacked at some point, the promotions on the heavy cav side still lend to Varro's being useful for a while, even if a support unit to do that final kill or do some extra damage or, you know, something.
It's true. It's true. Attack the damaged unit, lol.
Like, haha, you're weak, and I'm here, so you're even weaker. Nah.
Oh, you're so weak, you're practically day.
Surround and pound the muskets.
Muskets? Mech infantry.
Well, you probably want to attack the mech infantry with something else first.
Maybe.
Our next step, and I realize, yes, we're going out of our alphabetical order, but as I said at the start of the show, in recognition of our guest and knowing a certain civilization our guest very much enjoys and is familiar with.
I'm probably going to get laughed at for my pronunciation of this, because I always pronounce it with a hard C, but Scythia, or Scythia, as some people pronounce it, is actually one of my favorite civs in the entire game. Just for their early pony rush, I guess is the best way of putting it.
Ponies.
Yeah, ponies!
Oh boy.
Very much my enjoyment of this civilization. And I don't normally play a domination direction, so me immediately gravitating to Temiris was kind of funny. Their civ ability is People of the Steep, or Steppe. They receive a second light cavalry unit or Saka horse archer every single time you train a light cavalry unit or Saka horse archer, which in early barb destruction can be quite fun, just because you can get lots of ponies out there and run them around and kill everything very quickly.
And it's worth pointing out that train is not just a generic term. We do mean train. You cannot buy and then get a second one. It has to be trained in the city.
Yes.
You have to build it.
Yes, you have to build them. Their leader bonus being a +5 combat strength when attacking wounded units, and then when they eliminate a unit, they heal up to 50 hit points. So being able to chain kind of like attacks to get your opponent units down, so say you've got the two units, one's already injured, you can heal it up quite easily by sort of one unit taking them down quite a bit, and then final one that's injured healing when you kill it. So it's a lot of fun to combine running the ponies around, I guess is the best way of putting it for me. They're also very faith-based with their unit of the Kurgan, and that's also a pretty early improvement that you can get in the game. It comes straight from animal husbandry, so if you're pushing horses, you're going to get the Kurgan right away. What it does is it gives +1 gold, +1 faith, and then +1 faith from an adjacent pasture, so building them together is always really good, even though it cannot be built on hills. So that's the thing you should keep in mind when you're using it. And later on, you can get an additional +1 gold from guilds and a +1 gold from capital. So Kurgans can really help push gold, I guess is a good way of looking at it, so that if you do need to buy more units in the future, that's a way to do it. But relying on People of the Steppe really does a lot in the early game to sort of just push units out there and deal with the barbs when they're being pains in the butt, which they can be quite a bit.
Why would you want to put that on a hill in the first place?
You wouldn't want to put it on a hill. You want to put it next to your ponies so that they can see your nice little stone thing.
So you're going out and you're attacking all of these units, barbarians or otherwise, and maybe get yourself a great general.
Yeah, fairly quickly you can get one. Combining great generals to just sort of really boost what you're doing.
Now, I've seen some discussion on CFC, specifically Ardent 11, says I'm still a bit divided on district strategy. I'm often running campuses, but I get the impression I'm quote-unquote supposed to go encampments with Scythia.
You can run encampments with Scythia.
You're trying to build non-unique horse units. That can help. Yeah. It's also your best bet to get an early great general.
Yes.
If you really want to push it fast.
Yeah, that's true.
I wouldn't spam them, but it's worth getting a couple if you're going to fight that much.
And the earlier on, the better, of course, to be able to get that great general and then pair them with all your mounted units as they go squishing things across the map.
And quickly, too.
Yes, I mean, the movement at which these units can move is also to their advantage. So, yeah, you got your encampment, so you get your great general point of turn. And then you can also be getting your stable as well as one of the buildings within your encampment. because then that's going to give you some production. Another great general point, and it's going to give you combat experience for your light and heavy cavalry units that are trained in the city.
Yeah, it does a lot to just help build up the cavalry units that you are doing. And I don't know, I use them a lot for barbarian clearing and then watching my borders to kind of keep barbarians out.
In terms of her agenda, what is Tomris's agenda?
She's backstab-averse, so she dislikes surprise declarations of war from other civilizations, especially if she's a neighbor of the civilization who declared surprise war.
You know, I see that agenda, and I think yes, because all the other leaders are totally pro-backstab. You backstabbed me! Thank you so much! What?
Yeah, but the thing is, if she sees someone else doing it, she's, like, doubly likely to attack you.
Yeah, any declaration on the city-state is considered a surprise war as well. So, Germany being around.
Yeah.
You don't want to be Germany and be next door to Scythia, essentially.
She and I tend not to get along in general for some reason. I can't quite pinpoint why that is.
And just going back to our earlier conversation of trade routes, external trade routes are bad with her because she will use them if she's attacking you. Because the units can just move so much faster along them. If I'm playing someone else and I'm at war with them, I will definitely use, like, trade routes to get there faster.
Oh, of course. As Scythia, you want external trade routes.
You do.
Well, so free roads to your brand new cities.
Exactly.
So I think the Sack of Horse Archers should come at archery, not at horsemen. It's just kind of annoying.
Yeah, but they're fun to kill things with, so I'm not going to argue against them where they're coming from. But.
No, they're still useful. I just dislike that she has to wait till the classical era to get both units.
Well, then she's going to have to put in a little bit of effort then, isn't she?
Just build Kurgans for a while, and then you'll be riding high when you're ready.
That's pretty straightforward what Scythia's advantage is here, which is early.
Very early. Although I should note that the double unit, is helicopters in the atomic era. So you can have sky horses if you want, but you just have to wait a little while. It also includes cavalry.
Yep. Double up the cav, double up the helicopters. Double helicopters.
Double helicopters all the way across the sky.
Scythia, beat up all the things now, beat up all the things later.
Yeah.
A little bit of fighting.
I mean, you could go for a faith win with her as well, but...
You can go for anything with her when the enemy only has a city.
Yep.
It'll be riveting gameplay to hit end turn 50 times, but you can do it.
Recording for episode 264 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, Magian, Bibor, and Eek.
What it is Dan's on the top 10 list of games that are considered very replayable, and he's happy because Civ is so high on it.
Yeah, so Civ was third. Specifically, we're looking at the most unique and creative ways that video games encourage players to play through the whole game repeatedly from start to finish, which means if it's possible to 100% the game without going from start to finish multiple times, it's out. Although, they do fail on this video. There is a fail. And it's a big one, because it impacts number one. They say there are rules. We're only focusing on the single-player aspect of the game's level. And because of this, it was a tight list, one game per franchise. What's number one on the list? The Mass Effect series.
Yeah, that's
fine. You can just pick any of them.
Pick one.
Fine.
Not only that, they have Fallout 4 and, what's it called?
Yeah, Witcher.
Witcher.
Which and Resident Evil, the series.
It's really
story
bad.
Story-based games are not replay-intensive.
I mean, what about Tetris? It's a completely replayable game, and it's always different from the start.
Yeah, but it knows games, so...
Yeah.
What about Super Mario? What about Heroes of Might and Magic?
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's subjective.
Yeah, it is. And there's subjective list.
Yeah, like King's Bounty and, I don't know, a bunch of games.
I just wanted to call them out on their kind of failing to follow their own rules in a couple respects.
Yeah, you look at their honorable mentions, they've also got XCOM in there. I mean, well, I don't know if you really want to replay it that much, but... And there's FTL, which Phil knows all about replaying multiple times.
Give it an honorable mention, and I've no life that
better
game
than an honorable mention.
It's the YouTube, man. Anything goes.
Yeah, pretty much.
I like these people actually know what they're doing.
Well,
the thing.
Number 3, Civilization 5. Think you can cultivate, explore, and expand the span of an entire nation in one playthrough? Not a chance. this highly successful 4X turn-based strategy demands players take control of their own civilization and lead them through 1,000 years of development. Victory conditions vary on a number of factors, ranging from diplomacy, research, economic growth, and military conquest.
And I'm thinking, okay, you talk about diplomacy, research, and military conquest. You said the word victory conditions. Okay, so, yes.
This isn't Alpha Centauri. You can't win by cornering the energy market.
It's also not Civilization Revolution with an economic victory. So I'm like, oh, what? Although, I do have to give them some kudos, and this ties back in particular to Gandhi and India and Civ. They do say that
your approach to other nations, which can either be handled peacefully or, of course, through violence.
Cue on screen, nuke strike.
Yes.
They got that right. Recorded for episode 266 of Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Drusane, Ruben, and ZT Zarish. Watch Mojo. If applies to Civilization V, Civilization VI, all the way back to the original Civ on the PC.
Yes, indeed. It's the inside joke thing.
These jokes prove that video game developers really do have a sense of humor.
Basically, this is the list of from WatchMojo top 10 inside jokes for gaming series.
For this list, we're looking at inside jokes that the developers snuck into a game regarding the development process. These can be anything from jokes about scrapped ideas, hidden jokes about the developers, or anything else regarding the game's development. And we're only looking at jokes that developers put in their own games regarding their own creators.
Smack dab in the middle is number 5, Gandhi's affinity for nukes. And I didn't realize that in the first game, because that's been stated back to the first civilization. So, okay, in the first civilization, he had an aggression level of 1. But if you had diplomatic relations with a nation, it would lower their aggression level. So the game would loop that over to the max value. So Gandhi was super aggressive in the first Civ. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, because so, it would change the modifier to -1, and the game didn't understand that. So it made it the maximum of like 250 or something.
Yeah. And so there's also Civ 5 where he has a huge value for liking nukes. And of course, that's gone meme status long ago. In my recollection, however, I don't think he's had anything like this in Civ 2 through 4. I've played 4 a lot, and for a while I knew the AI weights in Civ 4 like the back of my hand. I still, for the life of me, can't come up with anything that was made Gandhi particularly aggressive or nuke happy in Civ 4, so I don't know what he's talking about with all the games in this series.
Yeah, I think it was the press, thanks to the internet. And by the time Civilization V was in development, it was, oh, we should actually purposely bring this back in, because this seems to be a thing. I find it odd in a way. It's kind of like the Star Trek equivalent of Beam Me Up Scotty. You don't know anything about Star Trek, you've heard the phrase. You don't play Civilization, you've probably heard about Gandhi liking nukes. So it's taken on a life of its own. I like that this was initially not intended to be a joke. Like, this truly was a bug that became a feature, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, pretty much.
I also like from the video.
I think we can safely say that the Civilization series is not historically accurate.
Really? Really? Is that... Wow, I don't think we've ever talked about that ever. I'm thank you, WatchMojo, for bringing that to our attention.
Yeah, that's great.
Recorded for episode 273 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, and Mad Jin.
Sean being talking about a recording on the narration for Civilization 6. Most of it until they tell him this, I guess he thought his narrator character survived through the whole thing, but no, if you're paying attention at the end of the intro video, he's actually dead.
But I thought I survived this.
He only has himself to blame for that disappointment, though.
Wait a minute. You're blaming him for being disappointed that he fulfilled a meme that was started by all the things he's been in that he didn't actually write himself?
Yeah. He agreed to it.
Seth didn't tell him his character was going to die.
We had this little debate about how many times he actually died and when he died. And it proves out that is exactly one and only time he actually dies.
Yeah, because you see him doing other things, you see him come back in the next era, but this time, no, you don't see him, you see the daughter with the picture.
Yep, and she has a sad face.
Happy case, I'm going to space the sad face because I don't have my dad.
Yep, so he dies.
I mean, either that or she's crying over the fact that she lost the source file for the photo and can't print it out again, because it's looking kind of wrinkled. I mean...
That's gotta be it. That's gotta be it.
Totally.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
I feel like every Civ game, without exception, since they implemented the concept of unique units, when they make late-game unique units, there's like a design void or something there. Late-game unique units, because they are so late, probably should be stronger relative to early-game units. I mean, I guess you could do a late-era start, but nobody plays those. Not nobody, but very few people actually play those. And if you're going to do that, then why not just have a really strong game unit? The problem with these units is that by the time they're available, it's extremely unlikely that they are going to change the outcome in a significant fashion. Way less likely than early unique units.
Yeah, I mean, if you're playing on a water map, then yeah, I can see a mass pack of U-boats ripping through somebody else's navy. I don't think the AI is nearly as bad with its movement navy as it was in Civ 5, but it still kind of sucks.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty low bar.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on Polycast episode 282. I'm the main team, the master of riveting gameplay, and today I was joined by regular panelists Dan Q.
Culture Killer.
Makalua.
Home of riveting podcasting.
Majin.
Still sleepy.
And guest co-host Codex.
Hi, bye.
We're not advocating the deep web here, Dan. Just
we're on. Not? Why am I here, then?
I think, really, Hannah, you are here in part to prove once and for all that maybe, just perhaps, possibly, Mackie is not the only woman on the internet. I
knew that was coming.
I know. Damn it, Dan. We made it, like, a solid 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, without that joke.
That's actually a good amount of time for Dan.
Yeah, it's true.
It is.
We actually got through the introduction before this happened.
No, we got through the internet. It's done. There's nothing left. Get out.
The internet.
DLC 5 and 6 and something called Civ GH are now in the SteamDB, and 2KQA has been activated. Whatever that crap's listening.
Well, thanks for that.
One stupid shuttle thing. I didn't open enough tabs, guys. I need more tabs.
You need more tabs.
More tabs.
Speaking of just Dan things, my Senate topic. Oh.
That's how we transition into Greek.
We transition into the Greeks. So, yeah, there's Civ. Play it. No, okay, we'll talk about it more. I'm just kidding. And, of course, the best game can be one where you actually have both Greeces in the game. And then they're in a cage match. I don't know, maybe that's fan fiction. Who knows?
One Greece enters. Sorry, two Greece enters.
One yeah, game. One Greece enters.
Yeah, this is the game that's only one Greece.
I blame Dan.
Well, you should, seeing as how I set the topics. I mean,
as well you should.
What's the conclusion?
Don't blame me. I didn't pick the order, Dan did.
You shared information about your life with me, so for that you should
be sorry.
That's
true.
And you know, it's interesting you mentioned Canadians, because Canadians actually outnumber Americans on this panel.
Yes.
Yep.
And you've all had more of a swing at trying to speak French than I have, so there you go. Well, if something pronounces with Spanish then I could probably help, but anyway.
Spanish just sounds a lot like French.
Not exactly.
Quality over quantity, and my gosh, no.
All right, episode title, I mean, Spanish sounds a lot like...
Everything's solid. Spanish sounds a lot more like French than like... I don't know, Chinese or something.
They're all romance languages derived from Latin anyway, so, I mean...
Yeah. I mean, they're kissing cousins, but they're still only cousins, not brothers and sisters.
It would not be good to mistake one for the other.
And then, of course...
Did you say they were kissing cousins, not kissing brothers and sisters?
Yes.
It is somewhat
well.
Better.
Record date May 27th, 2017. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.